The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 211 for Monday, July 13th, 2009.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire.
I am John Braun in a undisclosed location. I'm sorry. I was inspired by the recent Dick Cheney news. I'm sorry. No more politics. Let's move on. Dave, you had a pretty, if you don't mind my prying, but you had a pretty exciting last several days. I think you had, I just want to know a little bit, and then we'll move on.
Sure.
But I think you had some aviation adventures and then
a
heartwarming reunion adventure, which actually I'm going to be doing one of those in a couple of months too. But you were flying, dude.
Yeah, so I did. I had a trip down to Connecticut for my high school reunion, my 20th, for those of you that wanted to bother to do all the math. And it was actually good because my high school had undergone a pretty serious renovation, to the tune of about $70 million a couple of years back, actually probably about 10 years back. And I had not been in there since the day I graduated, I don't think. And so we did a tour of the school before the reunion. So that was cool. And you know what? It was great getting to see, a lot of old friends and some familiar faces and all that good stuff.
All right.
So,
I have to ask, did you tour the computer room or rooms?
Yeah. Oh, and there were Macs in the art department and Dells in the business department. Mm. So, yeah.
Typical.
Yeah, you know.
Okay.
But I went down a little bit earlier. My brother, for Father's Day, my brother and I are both aviation enthusiasts, I'll say. I would imagine at some point we both will head down the path of getting our private pilot's licenses. But
cool. So you flew from New Hampshire?
No. So I drove for Father's Day. My brother received what they call a discovery flight from his family. And essentially what it is it's you get it. You know, you buy an hour's worth of time in a plane with an instructor. They put you in the left seat, in the pilot seat, and up you go. And they take off and land the plane. Typically, I've done a couple of these and sometimes they'll let you take off. And one of them even let me land it
So do you share controls potentially, or is it like a driving, a driving instructor?
Every plane, every small plane, and I think even large planes have two sets of controls in both the anyone in either of the two front seats can fly the plane entirely.
Okay.
There's two sets of rudder pedals and two yokes, right? And one throttle, but that's in the middle. And so it's no problem. My brother had gotten this gift and he's had tried to schedule it a couple of weeks ago, but weather was terrible and all that. So he told me, I'm doing it Saturday. And I said, well, yeah, I'm going to come down on Saturday anyway. I said, are you doing a two-seater or a four-seater? And he said, a four. And I said, mind if I ride in the back? And he said, oh, no problem. So up we went. The weather was beautiful. We had this salty old instructor named Lloyd. If there's anyone on the planet that I would want to teach me to fly, it would be this guy. He was, no bones about it. He just wanted to show people how to fly, do it safely and all that. He was, would be a good instructor, but not buried in the minutiae. It was, just fly the stupid plane. And so we had a blast. The weather was beautiful. And I even took some videos. I took some pictures and some videos with the iPhone, including one of Lloyd landing the plane. Danbury is a tower controlled airport. So there was a lot of traffic coming. So Lloyd basically took the controls and set her down. But he did a great landing. Maybe 5 feet off the runway, the stall warning went, which is just about perfect.
Yeah,
it was great. So
this was a Cessna?
Mm-hmm. The Cessna 172 SP. I believe it was a 1998 plane. It was a gorgeous plane. I'd never been in a Cessna this nice before.
Okay. Yeah. I've once flown in a, two passenger plane.
Okay.
From what I recall, this was to Block Island. We did lunch one day. One of our coworkers who was leaving, we flew out of Sikorsky and we, went to Block Island for lunch. But I recall they get loud because you don't have the conveniences of like a big metal tube to sit inside. So
you're in a tube, but it's very aluminum and doesn't have any insulation. So
and you have a little canopy above you, and that's pretty much it between you and the big scary world, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, in the Cessna anyway, we all wore headsets and that's how we communicated right. with each other. And it was totally fine. But, you know, you listen to those iPhone videos and it's like, oh, yeah, it was pretty loud in the plane. So, yeah, that was fun.
So anyway, so, not to pry, but I thought it was cool because it encompasses some really geeky things. I think flight.
I used my iPhone. So, you know, I used to live in New Fairfield, Connecticut. And we were basically flying around, you know, New Fairfield, Sherman, Danbury area, kind of going near Candlewood Lake because the scenery was great. And as he positioned himself, they wanted him on a 4-mile approach coming in to runway 17 there. And as we started heading toward where he wanted to be for that, I'm like, well, wait a minute. I know where I am here. My old house is, gosh, I think it's right over there. So I pulled up on the iPhone, the Google satellite map and, I had it GPS me and it was like, okay, now I know where I am. And then I put my house, you know, my old address in there on Hillside Drive in New Fairfield there. And saw a picture of what it looks like now. And it had changed because they put a retirement community in right at the beginning of my street. And so I was like, oh, okay, I know where it is. And then sure, we flew almost right over my my old house, which was, you know, it was pretty cool. So it was cool. It was a fun day. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So waxing a bit historic, but that road there. So, yeah, basically you take Route 7 and at some point going to the Danbury Mall, you can take the road where they have a sign saying warning runway approach zone. And
that's
to
right.
me, that's a sign for awesome.
It's a fun airport.
We used to do that. Yeah. We used to, even as kids, you may have done this, but we used to park near the Danbury Airport and watch the planes land.
Is it a prerequisite that you have to be a kid to want to do that? Because I still do that now.
No.
Okay, good.
So, okay, enough.
But this is not Jack Hodgson's Uncontrolled Airspace podcast, but if you're into that, you should listen to Uncontrolled Airspace because it's an awesome podcast. It's awesome.
That's what he does. Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the things Jack does. Yeah. Yeah. So
nice.
All right. But moving on to Mac stuff. So we've got some questions and tips that we're going to go through, and then we're going to revisit Express Card because we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, and I've even had a change of heart on Express Card a little bit. And then yes, we are going to break our rule, and for three shows in a row, we're going to include the same topic, and it is going to be SSD because there's. Man, this.
Well, we got to settle a beat down.
We have to settle a little.
An unintentional, but maybe well deserved beat down. So, yeah, we'll save that to the end just to keep you hooked. So,
that's right.
Dave, go. Let's go with
okay.
Gray.
So, Gray writes, let's see. I'm reading my response. So, Gray says, I have two Intel iMacs, both running OS 10.5.7, sharing an internet connection over Wi-Fi using a single band time capsule. I also use an Airport Express to extend the network. Everything works fine for the most part, including printer sharing using an HP all-in-one on the Wi-Fi and sharing content on the Apple TV on the network. The problem occurs when I try to connect with my wife's iMac through the Finder, i.e. file sharing. Although file sharing is enabled in the settings on both computers, when I select my wife's computer from the shared devices column, there is a connection failed message in the Finder window. Clicking on the Connect As button brings up a password dialog impervious to any password associated with my user account or MobileMe account. Oddly enough, my wife's computer connects to mine as her MobileMe account name, no problem. Do I have some keychain problem? I dug into the Apple support site and came to a place where the suggestion was to reinstall Leopard. That takes me back to my Windows days. Ew. Please say it ain't so. Okay, so the good news is I think we had prepped this one for the last show and didn't get to it. So we have the answer because Gray, I sent an email off to Gray with a bunch of ideas and one of them did it, but let's kind of talk through this, a little bit that, you know, my initial feeling was the fact that it brings up the username and password dialogue is good. It means that the two computers are connecting. There doesn't appear to be any firewalls in the way, there's obvious communication, happening. And of course that works the other way too, if you're able to get connected. Right. So that, you know, that was important. And then, you know, the next thing we had asked him to do was to look in system preferences sharing. And obviously he says he has file sharing enabled, but make sure the users have some permissions, right? Because without, you know, if it's set to, you know, with no read, no write, it won't let you log in, maybe something along those lines. And then finally, on his wife's machine, we recommended that he go into system preferences and accounts and change the password. And the reason, John, that I suggested this is we know that the accounts work when he logs in the user interface, you know, when you're logging into the machine or you have to authenticate to, you know, install something that requires administrator password or what have you. But Apple File Protocol, from what I understand, runs as a Unix service. And so that's going to go ahead and look at the Unix passwords on the machine. Now, I might be wrong about this, but that was sort of my thought process was, there's one password, but I think it's stored in two different places and they're supposed to be in sync. But, you know, it's possible it could get out of sync for whatever reason.
I'm with you is that, you know, a lot of times these things get cached. And if the mechanism to indicate that it's bad or expired or needs refreshing is broken. So I think that's what happened here.
And it is. We heard back from Gray and he said, yep, changing the password certainly fixed it. And I think he could have even changed it to what it was as long as it forced, as you said, John, that refresh and kind of flushing everything out and rewriting all of those files were whatever it's reading. And I think it's the Unix password, you know, Etsy password or shadow password or whatever it is. I can't remember how OS X does it because every flavor of Unix, you know, has its own magic little way. But that did it. So if you're ever having those problems, you know, the other thing I told them to try was to go into system preferences and sharing and enable what's called remote login. And then you'd have to go into the terminal and the instructions are on the machine in which you enable it. But you go to the terminal on another machine and you use the SSH command to connect across the network that way. That would also test the Unix password availability there. You know, it gets file sharing out of the way and just tries a direct connection. So. But it did work, according to Gray. So,
now, I don't know if I missed this, but did you get the sense that these were all admin accounts or user and admin or a mix or what? Because
he did not say. My assumption was that all the accounts were administrator enabled. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Likewise, because, you know, I just got to take a little tangent.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But every machine that I have set up, either at work or home, I'm admin. I'm the boss. I really don't like on OS X to set up guest accounts or user accounts. I trust, first off, it's people I work with and I trust that they're not going to destroy everything. So pretty much even if we have a machine that has multiple users, I make them admins because the little quirks that come in there with Unix permissions, as well-intentioned as they are, Dave,
yeah,
with, you know, user and group and different permissions, I don't know. I feel kind of filthy because I'm also have a security background, and to say you should throw all that away for the sake of ease of use almost is like sacrilege. And maybe some people will wag their finger or shake their fist, but I just thought I'd comment on that. I don't know your feelings if you have anything.
I'm confused. You do just use an admin account as your main account or you set up
all the machines that I use, I will set up myself as well as others if they want accounts as admin. So I'm a total.
Okay.
And again, this is a finger or fist shaking move to make everybody on your machine admin.
Oh yeah.
But if you trust the people,
right.
So I'd say if you're in an enterprise environment, maybe that's not a good move. I mean, I work and the thing is I work, in an R&D group and we typically have small work groups of people that I'm not letting the entire company get to my machine. It's a small, trusted group of people, in which case I'm comfortable giving them admin, assuming they're not going to do something totally boneheaded.
Right. So the one place where I don't do, and this is a good tangent, the one place where I don't do that is on the iMac that we have in the house that everybody uses. My wife
including
the kids, right. So for the kids' accounts, I do not give them admin rights. Now, I don't use parental controls, you know, the built-in parental controls for this. And there's, you know, I've certainly thought about it, but I know what it's like. And we had them on for a little while. It gets in the way. It starts filtering things that I don't need it filtering or don't care to have it filtering. And frankly, from my own background, I know that as soon as I know there's a wall in my way, now my priority is to circumvent that wall, right? So if I want to teach my kids or give my kids an opportunity to hone those skills, then maybe I'll turn on parental controls. But, we're always around when the kids are on the computer, and I'd like to think we have a pretty good rapport with our children. So the parental controls thing, we have not found a need for it yet. That may change. You know, we always said we wouldn't be the type of parents that put our kid on a leash. And, you know, then we had our son, and when he was young, he walked it. He walked before he would talk to us, right? He was walking at like 8 months old. So it's like, all right, get the kid on a leash. Let's go, you know. So I'm happy to revisit that and perfectly happy to, yes, to have a nice meal of crow. But for the children, I do leave their account as non-admin. And the reason is because it not for what they would try to do that they know they're trying to do, but what they don't know. And if they're trying to do something and it comes up and asks them for a password, they're just going to type in their password because they know their password. Right. And I don't want them to have the ability to wreak havoc on the machine. At this stage, though I do also appreciate, again, based on my, experience, that having the ability to wreak havoc and wreaking that havoc is a great way to learn how to get out of it, and how to fix it.
And it sounds like a great chance or a great opportunity for a kid's machine.
It is. Yeah.
You lock it down a bit, and it's like if it gets nuked. It
doesn't matter.
Anyways, we are deviating. That's all right. I like this discussion tangent. because I've hung out with you, and I've seen the kids, and the kids are at least in front of me, well disciplined.
But
they're not going crazy. We'll do the child care.
Yes. Podcast. Yes, that's right. Again, this is neither the aviation podcast nor the childcare podcast. So, Michael writes, my name is Michael. I'm a web designer from the beautiful town of Haarlem, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong because it's not in New York. It's near Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Oh, my.
I very much like to listen to your show on my way to work. Okay. I am fortunate enough to own a brand new MacBook Pro, the 13-inch model that was launched at WWDC. Having worked with the machine for some time now, I noticed something different from the 13-inch MacBook I had before. When I am on battery power and it goes down to about 5% battery left, the OS will give the warning that the machine is about to go to sleep. When I keep working, the screen will go black and the machine will turn off. Now, on my older machine, I was used to seeing the blinking light come on. I would connect to power, press a key, and I would be back in business immediately. On the new machine, I really have to power it back up using the power key. It will then show a grayed out desktop with bars filling up from left to right, and then it will be back where I was. I know it is using deep sleep now instead of the regular sleep I was used to before. It's not really problematic, but I like the quick, regular sleep. Do you know if I can get it back that way, or is the hardware different in some way so you can only do deep sleep? Okay, so let's talk about what's happening first, John, and then I think you've got some ideas for perhaps how to do this. So when you see that, when you try to wake your computer up and it doesn't wake up, your laptop up and it doesn't wake up, and you hit the power button, and instead of seeing the normal boot process, you see sort of a, like he said, a washed out, gray, black and white version of whatever your desktop was the moment the computer went to sleep. And then this little progress bar that slowly crawls across the bottom of the screen. And then once it gets to the end, everything comes to color and your mouse is alive and your keyboard's alive and your computer is exactly back to where it was. What that is it's coming out of hibernation. It has saved the contents of RAM to a file, and that file is exactly as big as your RAM, the amount of RAM you have. So if you've got 4 gigs of RAM, that's a 4 gig file.
Where is that file?
Private /var/VM. It is in VM. Okay.
Sleep image.
Thank you.
Because I had a note for that. I wanted to blurt that out. Thank you. Go on.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. And here's the
but
thing.
But it is because if you try to mess with it, then it gets even more interesting. Because I think when I tried to mess with it, it's like, dude, it's like file busy. Just
right.
Don't.
Okay.
That file. No, I think if I had pushed it, I could look at that file because that probably has a lot of very interesting. And if you choose to, it's not. I'm sorry. It's not an encrypted VM.
No.
I think it's a different file.
It may be encrypted. I don't know.
Maybe.
If the sleep image
that's a good question.
Yeah.
We think alike. That's good. Because I know that there is a in a security control panel, I think.
Right.
System preference. Duh. There is a secure swap file option. This, I think, is just the sleep file, which is like, here's RAM. I'm going to sleep. I'm sorry. You can't stop me. When I wake up, this is what I am going to read. And then we'll take it from there.
Right.
So go on.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, that's right. So it saves this file out and then reads it back in. So that's what happens in Hibernate. The beauty of that is it actually shuts the computer off once it saves this sleep image file out. And so the computer is not using any battery time when it's asleep. But when you turn it back on, it's starting from scratch. So it has to refresh the contents of RAM by reading this file all the way back in. So what Michael wants is to avoid this. Now, this is where it gets interesting. By default, the Mac will save out the contents of RAM every time it goes to sleep, but it won't necessarily turn the computer off until the battery gets very low. And I think that number is, right, is below 20%. And at that point, it actually turns the computer off. And then you have to go through this process. But anytime you put a laptop to sleep that is set to the default settings, you have to wait for it to save this memory image out before it actually goes to sleep. And what'll happen is you'll see the light will remain, even though you've closed the lid or told it to sleep, the light will remain solid for, you know, up to a minute or maybe even a little longer as it saves this file out. And then it'll start going through the pulsing thing that says, yes, I'm on, but I'm asleep. But there's some ways to change this behavior, right, John?
There is. Of course there is. So the way we like to change it, well, there's the hard way and the easy way. We are going to talk about the easy way. The easy way is Smart Sleep. Smart Sleep is a utility that basically does what you could do from the command line or the terminal, but you don't want to do that. And it basically lets you change the behavior of the sleep or deep sleep function to say, all right, when you get to this point of battery depletion, do this. And I think what it does is it defaults to, if 5% or less of the battery is available, you're going to hibernate.
I think it's 20%.
Or is it 20? I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. It is. Yeah.
I may have set it to 5.
There you go. Sure. Sure.
Okay. So anyway, so this utility, and I do believe the utility goes into detail about what you can do on the command line. This is arcane command line terminal stuff that you could set as well. But I think to avoid this behavior, which I think is what is being asked, don't set the limit to something so low that when the machine is shot, it's shot and it's going to hibernate and you won't wake up unless you have a new battery. Because I've done this actually when I've traveled. I will set it at 5% or below. And when the machine gives up pretty much on the tail end of when I'm watching a DVD, which on the MacBook I have is about 2-something hours. Sometimes if I have a DVD that's 3 hours, the machine will shut down, orderly, save the file. I'm like, okay, I'm done. I take out my backup battery, and I always have a backup battery. Put that back in. The machine starts up. I see the gray screen with the increasing bar. It restores the DVD session, and I watch the rest of the movie. So
cool.
So I think Smart Sleep is a good way to, because again, it sounds to me like this behavior in this case is not desirable.
Right. Yeah. Now I think with Smart Sleep, certainly from the command line, using it's the PM set command. And if you go to the command line or, you know, open up terminal and type PM set, it will give you the command line switches that you can use to both get what the settings are and also manipulate them. And you've got 3 different states, if it's on battery, if it's on power, or if it's on UPS. And so, you know, your machine can react in different ways, but either from the command line. And also I think from Smart Sleep, you can set it to never hibernate and only sleep. The problem is if you set it to, you know, only hibernate and then, or only sleep rather, and it gets down to, you know, 1 or 2%, it will sleep, until the battery dies, and then it will turn off, but you won't have an image back, and it won't be happy when it comes back up. So,
It'll be in a recovery rebuild, whatever state.
Yeah. So, and that, you know, that can cause some grief. So this is why Apple did that. But, you know, if you don't like it, you can certainly bypass it, but make sure you do it eyes wide open and aware of what's going on.
I got to say is thinking about it as we move forward with bigger RAM capacities, because from what I've seen and looking in the private VAR VM file, that's as big as your RAM.
That's right.
So as we move forward, now we have, I believe the maximum for laptop max is 8 gigs.
That's correct.
Is that correct? On the 17?
Yeah. And so on the 13 and 15 now too, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Are we all up to 8?
I think so. Yeah.
So it takes a little time to write that out to disk.
And it also takes up a lot of disk space.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're someone like, say, me, who's, you know, still testing and living off of this SSD drive, you know, I'm running on a much smaller drive than I had before. So that space means a lot. So I have disabled hibernation. And then once you disable hibernation, you can go into that folder and remove the sleep image file and reclaim all that disk space. And of course, this is the show of tangents to beat all tangents. But but, you know, the way I always wind up stumbling on that file is by using Omni Disk Sweeper, which is to me, an invaluable tool.
It's free. It was in the back of my head. Yes they free. Were now free and it go on.
Yeah. So what you do is you launch this utility and tell it, yeah, go. And it goes and scours your hard drive and builds a column layout, organizing everything by that which takes up the most space, starting with the root level of your hard drive. So it'll list applications, users, library, system, etc. And you can see, okay, users is, you know, the most, and, you know, it's taking up 75 gigs or something. So you click on users, and then it might show you that, you know, in your library folder, you've got 10 gigs, and in your documents folder, you've got, you know, 40 gigs or something. So you click on library, and then you see in there, oh, mail has, you know, 9 of the 10 gigs. Okay, and so I dig into mail, and you can very easily figure out where all this stuff is, including the stuff in private VAR VM and all that. If you know what it is, or even if you don't, it will happily let you select and delete files right from there. Of course, I wouldn't delete anything if I didn't know what it was, but, you know, that's what Time Machine is for, I guess. So, but it's a very, very valuable program. I run it all the time. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Where are we?
We are at the point where I'm going to tell you about our first sponsor for the show, John.
Cool.
CircusPonies.com with Notebook. And Notebook, of course, is available with version 3.0. It's an electronic organizer application. It allows you to create notebooks that are, well, when you create them, they're empty. And you can put in them whatever you want. You could create one notebook to store the entire contents of everything you want, or you could create multiple notebooks to, you know, for different purposes or topics or whatever it is you want to do. The idea is, you start with a hierarchical layout where you can just type and, you know, tab in and just like on a notebook, but you're typing. Then you can pull in graphics, PDFs. You can build in it's got a little scratch pad so you can go in and write things. You can OCR the contents of a PDF. You can mark up PDFs. Everything that's in there is searchable, and not just within one notebook, but you can search across all of your notebooks at once. So if you had tagged something with a keyword, or you remembered the date that you had put something in, any of that, you can search it and boom, it's going to find it for you across multiple notebooks. This is available at CircusPonies.com. Of course, free 30-day test drive, which is great. And then $50, $49.95 US when you're ready to purchase. All available at CircusPonies.com. Are we ready to go? It's time to go on to Dan, I think. I think we should make sure we hit that. Right, John?
Hit it.
Hit it. Here we go.
Hey, guys. It's Dan from LA. Thanks so much for the great podcast. Always an awesome listen. Wanted to really quick touch on the power line adapter that you guys mentioned in your most recent podcast. Pete said several times in other podcasts, including this one, that the maximum number that you should be able to use is 2. I've got a very special client that I've set up three at for various reasons that I'm not going to go into here. These are devices that either have wireless turned off or don't have wireless. So I know that they're not like bypassing the power line adapter and still jumping onto the wireless, and that's how it's working. They are wired only, and they are using power line adapters. I'm pretty sure they were Netgear brand. The faster, and this is about 6 months ago that they were installed, so it was the faster ones 6 months ago, whatever speed that was. And I've not had any complaints about those devices connected via the power line adapters. So either I'm just lucky, Pete's unlucky, or maybe his wiring is bad, or maybe the adapters he has in the buy are bad, or maybe the brand that he's got have issues. But just my experience, your mileage may vary. If, in fact, a listener is really, really wishing he could do that, I encourage them to try it. Buy them from Best Buy and return them if they don't work. That's my advice. Have a great one and keep up the great work.
Thanks, Dan. And indeed, we had several other listeners write in with exactly that same advice and experience that you can use. You know, I think one guy said he had four, maybe even five of them running. So there is some intelligence in there. I guess each of them, you know, announces or broadcasts, however it's broadcasting its packets, it's doing it with some ID so that it's, you know, a virtual hub, I guess.
Bridge?
Yeah, sure. But it's a multi-point bridge, right? It's sure. Not just, you know, a bridge to one place. So, yeah, very cool. We got to get some of these and test them out. I can see a lot of, you know, it perfect for not wanting to rip holes in your walls. This is a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I was at the, I got the card. I'll call the Belkin person.
Yeah. Yeah,
as you and I saw, I think there's a lot of demand because when you and I went to the webpage for the product, it was like sold out. I'm like, all right, either they pre-announced it or there's a mad rush on this product because gigabit in your house, dude, that's cool.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you'd have to get, either copper or fiber, right?
Yeah. You could do gigabit in your house with Cat 5e, right?
Yeah, 5e or 6 or whatever the heck it is. Yeah, right. 5e. No, I think you're right. 5e is the minimum.
That's what I'm running is 5e, and I get 980.
Yep.
So
cool.
Do you know about iPerf? I'm gonna because we're in the show of all tangents. So iPerf
spin it
is a great. You know, you set up a network and you want to test throughput on it. Now, most of the time, what you're going to do is try to transfer a file, right? But the problem with transferring a file is you're reading it from a disk and writing it to a disk, you know, on one side or the other.
Variables, man.
Right. And as we know, I don't have any disk drives that will go, transfer data at a gigabit reading or writing, you know, at most.
No, you don't have a fiber array.
I don't have a fiber array. I apologize.
All right.
Well, but I found this little utility. It's a Unix utility. You can get it for Windows, Linux, and Mac called iPerf, I-P-E-R-F. And what you do is you open up a terminal session on one machine and you navigate to wherever you've installed iPerf and you type iPerf space dash S. And that puts it in server mode. And so it just sits there. And then you go to another machine and you say iPerf space dash C, and then you type in the IP address of the computer that's running as the server. And for 10 seconds, it blasts data as fast as it can from the server to the client. And and you get a report, and it's like perfect. And you do that two or three times in a row, you get a good feel. And you can tell it, I want to go 30 seconds. I want to do it this way. I want it to have packet sizes this big, et cetera, et cetera. But the deal is it's generating its own data and just sending it. Not reading, not writing, just using the network connection, and it's a very handy troubleshooting utility, and it's really the only way I've ever seen my network go at full tilt with gigabit. I mean, like I said, there's no other way.
Nice.
So yeah, highly recommend it. It's free, like most of the stuff that we've come to rely on. As Abdullah wrote, this is another good little tip.
Oh, yeah.
Regarding your listener, a Windows migrant, asking about monitoring disk activity on a Mac, a little used Perl is that in the dock, You can have Activity Monitor display disk activity or any of its other features right there in the dock. All you have to do is click and hold on the Activity Monitor icon in the dock. The little submenu will appear. Scroll to the dock icon submenu of that menu and select Show Disk Activity or any of the other choices. Disk activity will be promptly displayed in the dock icon. This is very handy, especially if you run into a situation where menu meters or iStat menu can't or won't run. Activity Monitor can be your friend. You have to have Activity Monitor running first.
Yep. But now, if you're too lazy to click on the dock, mm-hmm. you can go in the Activity Monitor menu, click on View, and say dock icon.
Ah.
Same menu.
Okay.
Just a little backup if you're into the menu navigation
sure.
sort of thing. But that's cool. So this is the poor man's or, you know.
Yeah, menu meters is free. So, I mean, but, you know, this is the man or woman who doesn't have a network connection to go and download menu meters, right?
I mean, and I would say the only downside with menu meters is that the menu space is kind of depending. Yeah. Now, I don't know about you. Now, I have right now, Dave, my biggest screen at home, at least for the computer, is a 19-inch. I have a 22 or 24-inch at work. And I've noticed that the Mac OS sometimes will truncate what's in the menu.
Right. Oh, absolutely. The menus that start on the left, i.e. Apple and then application, file, edit, those take priority right. over the stuff that grows out of the right, all the little widgets and tools. And
right.
Apple.
Now,
Apple,
some of them. But I'm going to say the Apple ones, well, you'll know if it's an Apple one because if you hold down, I believe it's Apple,
yeah.
and you click on a menu, if it lets you mess with it, it's an Apple menu.
No, I'm not sorry. True. You can do that with your menu meters ones,
no,
too.
No, sorry. No, I'm sorry. What key?
It's the command key.
I'm sorry. It's option. Option lets you, but there's one key with Apple menu items that lets you mess with them more than normal.
Really? Huh. All right. I'll have to try that. Because, yeah, all I'm finding here is that the command key is the one that lets you reorder them and you know, set how they appear, which is very handy.
No, again, command. Yeah. So command on Apple menu items lets you drag them out of the menu bar or move them about.
Right.
Unfortunately, it's not universal, which would be nice with some of the ones.
You can't reorder menu meters if you hold down the command key and move them around.
That is correct.
Really?
Because I think they're adhering to...
But I can.
Well, no, you can't.
I just did. I'm moving my menu meters things
Apple
around.
Apple or... Which key?
The command key.
We'll talk.
Okay. Yeah, it's working fine.
Well, no, I'm menu meters. Let's see. No, I'm sorry. No, you're correct. Menu meters adheres, but no. So I'm clicking on Dropbox.
Ah.
Smart menu... network monitor, which is part of what we all love.
Right. Yeah. So
little snitch. So no, you're right.
Yeah,
some apps let you hold down the key to move them about in the menu. Some do not.
Now here's a little tangent. Apple does not like other things to act like menu items. They're fine with the way Dropbox does it, where it's an app and it just sort of launches and appears in order. But they do not like this, and they have been known to change the APIs to break that. So
I think what these people are doing is known as breaking the law.
Breaking the law.
Oh, we're so in sync. All right, what's coming up?
Let's see. Should we?
Bow out? No.
That's it. No, we're not done. We're not done. Let's go through Alex.
Go.
Alex. Oh, yeah, that's right. I got to play it. I'm thinking, I know, but you have the answer, John. Man. Why do I have to?
Hey, guys. This is Alex in Berkeley, California, and I love the show, and I'm excited to send this in. I just traded from a 17-inch dual-core iMac to a 13-inch dual-core MacBook. Because basically I want to get out of the house more and I'm spending a lot of time at my desk. I was a PC convert 2 years ago when I got the iMac, and this is my first Apple laptop. I love the Apple experience. I'm totally into it. I'm aware that people like to suss out the fans on the laptops and sort of control them, and that you got to – there's better and worse things to do vis-a-vis battery life. And, you know, I'm trying to look into all that kind of stuff. My question is basically this. What are your top pieces of advice or favorite apps that someone on a MacBook should know or employ that a desktop user might not have top of mind? Rock on and don't get caught.
Thanks, Alex. All right, John, I know you've got, got some ideas here.
I'm launching. So he was saying, what do I need to know different from a portable, from a laptop or iMac? Sorry.
Right.
To me, the top of my list would be ventilation. Check your heat. I would do either temperature monitor or thermograph 10.
Okay.
So definitely on a laptop, you want to keep in touch with that. And also the fan speed. So iStat, I think, is good for that, or iStat Pro.
Yep.
Is good for the fan speed, Dave. In addition, well, no, I don't think Menu Meters does that.
Not.
No, they do not.
No.
Okay. So Menu Meters is our favorite, but they do not do fan speeds. Now, in addition, a little tangent, I'm sorry. There's something called SMC fan control. I don't know if I necessarily recommend mucking with the way the Mac operates the fans in response to heat events.
Okay.
If you want to, go for it. I would say I don't have a problem if you exceed the specs. If you're going to back off, then, well, yeah. That's bad.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Other things I would say on a portable is be very aware of your battery behavior and what you're doing. So something like battery health monitor would be good just to understand how your battery or... there are a couple others. We'll list them. But understanding how what you do affects your battery life, I think that's very important for the current crop. Because we've even seen today, Dave, where there were a number of tweets about battery life and stuff. And the problem is, you know, battery life is just, it's tough.
Yeah.
But I think you have to keep in mind what you're running. If you're running a DVD, if you're running a hard drive, if you're running wireless, if you're doing all this stuff, it's gonna reduce your battery. I'm sorry. The thread I was thinking of was some people online, which we saw today, Dave, were saying 7 hour battery life on the latest Macs. And I think the consensus from we saw a couple of our good friends, I don't want to implicate them, but they were saying, you know, realistically, it may get 3 hours out of the latest Macs.
Okay.
Now, they claim 7 hour battery. Of course, the footnote is under your your mileage may vary.
Right.
So
right.
Now I see on my machine, and I think your machine, Dave, I think our machines are similar.
Yep.
I see about 2 to 3 hours max.
I think I get about 3. I don't think I hit much below 3. But
yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah.
Our batteries with the capacity, I think it's 55 milliamp hours max and stuff. But I would say Apple's guidelines with the 7 hour battery with the latest machines should be taken with a grain of salt. And they put this grain in their fine print. They're like depending on usage and applications.
Right.
If you're sitting there doing nothing.
Right.
It'll last 7 hours. If you're playing back a movie and ripping a DVD and you know, doing all sorts of things. So that's.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
My input.
All right. I was going ahead and getting a jump start on the show notes for you while you were listing all those apps. So
excellent. But there's a lot of things. And the other, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
The motion sensor.
Okay.
It's cool. But be careful. No, there's a few apps that show your orientation with a portable. Probably not too important. Just get a good case.
Not.
Don't drop it.
Right.
Okay. But Dave, in your experience on a portable.
I think you hit it. I mean, that's it. I have nothing to add. You had all the ones I had, so I was just adding them to the show notes for you. Yeah. No, we're good. our second, before we get on to the Express Card stuff, I want to make sure we talk about our second sponsor for the show, which is Barebone Software with BB Edit. Now, we're up to BB Edit 9.2.1, I believe, and there's lots of cool things that BB Edit does. It's been around for a long time. They've built this app up. It is the thing they use to code with over there. So it is built by and for programmers, but they've taken it a step further and really opened it up to anyone wanting to do any sort of text manipulation. If you have some text operations that you need to do regularly, reformatting or swap, you know, find and replace, that sort of thing, you can create what they call little text factories and apply those to different bits of text. It's even AppleScript and automatorable, so you can include those in your automator scripts. If you're someone who's just going to use it for, say, programming even HTML, it's great. As soon as it realizes that you're editing an HTML file, it'll start highlighting and color coding all of your code. As you put, let's say, you know, table cells, or you define a table, well, it'll give you a little triangle in the sidebar. And once you've built that table and you're happy with it, you can twist that triangle up and it will fold the code all up. So you don't see the whole contents of the table there in your code anymore. You just get the little table. And you can do that with all of your little opening and closed functions so that you can have a nice clean looking piece of code on your screen and then twist down just the ones that you want to edit and then twist them all back up. Of course, you can see it all laid out there. You don't have to fold them up if you don't want, but that's how it works. Again, it's Barebones Software at barebones.com. It's BB Edit 9. It's $125 to purchase. It's $30 to upgrade from prior versions and $49 if you're a student. And of course, you can download a free trial all at barebones.com. Now, recently we talked about the Express Card slot and how it's going away. Let's just start with Jonathan's comment here, maybe we'll even let Chris's comment. No, there's no way. We'll get to the fish shake. We'll get to that. We'll play Jonathan's. We've had a couple of people write in and call in rather with good ideas for how they use this Express Card.
Hey, this is Jonathan, and I was just listening to your latest installment, and you mentioned the Express Card 34, and I actually have three different Express Card 34 devices. One that I use all the time is an 8-gig SSD like the one that you mentioned, although I got my 8-gig for $10. I found it on sale somewhere. I thought, shoot, give me memory. And so I use that to back up my clients folder on an ad hoc basis. Every day I've got a variety of backups that run automatically, but every once in a while I'll throw a whole client folder on this 8-gig SSD Express Card 34 device. I also have I have an SD card reader, and I also have an eSATA adapter that fits in the Express Card 34 for external eSATA drives. So I've also heard of other people using the SSD drives in some of these high-end video cameras use them, and so they can dump their video to the MacBook Pro very quickly using one of these cards, whereas it would have, you know, a variety of other ways, USB or whatever, would take a lot longer. So that interface will be missed sorely by a lot of people. And have a good day. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Hey guys, great show. Chris here, and I thought I would send this in defense of my poor Express slot in my MacBook Pro. I have a late 2008, and the Express Card slot I use constantly for two different things. I primarily am a video editor, a Final Cut Studio user, and I'll either have one of two things in that slot at all times, and one is either a second FireWire card, because working on a MacBook Pro out in the field, my internal drive isn't big enough or fast enough, really, to capture HD video. So I'll have one FireWire 800 drive plugged in to the built-in port, and then my camera also comes in over FireWire using the Express card slot, so I have a separate controller in there. Final Cut actually won't let me capture unless it's unless the camera is on a second controller. It says it's not fast enough to run them both off the same bus. And then the other thing I often have in my Express card slot is a device from Matrox that lets me capture video directly in a ProRes format. It's a very high bandwidth, requires a lot of throughput that only Express card slot can deliver. It's even too fast for FireWire 800, which means in the future, my only choice is the 17-inch, which is kind of a bummer because right now the sweet spot for me in terms of screen real estate while out in the field is the 15-inch because it's not too big and it's just the right size. But I know a lot of you out there don't need the Express card slot, and I understand the SD is very fancy, but no dice for me. All right, guys, great show.
Thanks, Chris. And John, I believe Jonathan and Chris are not alone in having things to use for their Express card slot, because you've joined those ranks.
I have not. No, I have. Now, number one, you know, I'm really questioning, after we've had multiple listeners tell us, you know, dude, I use this card for this. So yep. I think what we're seeing is Apple attempting to create a divide between the 17-inch, right, and the 15-inch and below. And I don't think what they've done is well thought out.
All right, so what...
Yes,
what?
I will suffer. In that, I still think the 15-inch is a viable platform for high-performance video and other hardware. I don't want a 17-inch. I'm sorry. I've sure. seen it. It's a battleship.
Yeah, it's too big.
I'm sorry. It's yeah. it's a mobile desktop, but it is not a nice machine to travel with. As you know, my love was the 12-inch PowerBook. I think the 13-inch MacBook Pro is as close as you're going to get to a machine that is comfortable to travel with. So I feel bad for these people.
Now, what I mentioned that you joined the ranks of
I'm
Express
sorry.
Card slot.
So what I ordered. So I was poking around because you challenged me, as you
right.
did multiple times in the last show.
Yes.
But we'll get to that. You're saying, John, what are you doing with your, you know, Express card slot?
Right.
My answer was truthfully nothing. So between when you kind of encouraged me to think about this, I went online and I ordered a Express Card SD card reader.
There you go.
The intent being, I want to see what it's like, because right now I actually do have, so SD
now what,
is...
And just ballpark, what did you pay for that?
$30.
There you go. Okay, so cheap.
And the card itself was probably $50 or something,
for
so
the,
I have a...
For an SD card.
Which, I have which a 16 gig... which I originally got for my camera.
Right, right, exactly.
But for the camera I have, you need a class, I don't know why they call it class 6, I guess, SD card. If you could look it up, it'd be great. But anyways, it was like, where did class 6 come from?
Sure.
Where's class 1 through 5? But no, it was a high-speed SD HC card, which I guess is enhanced the capacity. But that is the card I'm going to put in this HD reader just to see.
Great.
What can I do? Because we were talking about RAM drives. I think both you and I, Dave,
sure.
love RAM drives if they fit in and they work seamlessly for the most part with the OS.
Right.
Otherwise. So I am diving into that. Now, we've had some listeners get actual HD, and maybe this is jumping ahead and you want to.
Yeah, no. Yeah, we don't want to go there yet. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Go.
Yeah. So I had a long conversation this week with Larry O'Connor from.
He's smart.
He is very smart, from Otherworld Computing. And he, full disclosure, Otherworld is a premier sponsor at the site. They don't sponsor the podcast, at least not yet. But they're a sponsor of TMO. No, I just want to make sure that, you know. And so that was the reason, because that's part of that program. I had a chat with him this week, but we wound up getting onto a lot of this stuff. And we're definitely going to have him on as a guest of the show. This guy is smart. I mean, not only has he been in the industry for 21 years, but he knows what he's doing. He's, you know, he's not just a guy that runs a company. He knows exactly how this technology works and really understands it. But
he's not marketing.
Well, he is, but I mean, he also happens to not just marketing. Right. So, he was saying, you know, this is interesting. And I don't think the 17 is going to keep that express card slot for very long. I think Apple is phasing it out, you know, and his philosophy was that, yeah, you know, okay, so what if it's only 10% of the users that are using it now? Down the road, we all have the ability to expand. And as you have pointed out, for $30, you can get that same functionality that Apple is going to force upon you with the new MacBook Pros, right? Because it's right there. Or you can expand and you can do eSATA and you can do all this other stuff. And it limits the expansion options of this machine. So I've come full circle on this. I don't think getting rid of the Express Card slot's a good idea, because why force people? Why limit expansion? And of course, there's a good reason to limit expansion. And that is people have to buy a new computer. You know, if you want to add an eSATA interface to your MacBook Pro, you can do that today for, I think, about $100, maybe even less. If you want to do that with the new MacBook Pros, well, you can't, you know. And if external eSATA drives become all the rage and replace FireWire and USB 2 because they're way faster, well, and they start putting them in the new machines, you're out of luck. You got to buy a new machine. Can't upgrade. So it, you know, it really kind of limits that. And it's interesting that Apple is willing to turn their back on 10% of their customers. I don't want to turn my back on 10% of mine. Certainly not in this economy, not in any economy. That's a sizable percentage of people. It's interesting.
It's Apple.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. No question. It is Apple.
Well, but they have, we've seen in the past, they said iMac.
Right.
Who needs floppy?
Right.
They probably were right, though.
They were right about that move. Yeah.
Not with the mouse.
Yeah.
Oh, I've had some fish shakes with a lot of people lately. I would say the iMac mouse deserves to be in the user interface hall of shame.
I'll give you that. I don't like it. Some people do, though.
The hockey puck.
Oh, that
the
thing.
First,
oh, that was terrible.
No, the first. The first rule is. Round bad. I have no frame of reference.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point.
Moving on.
Okay, so I have a kind of a crossover comment that's going to bring us into the SSD realm. I want to make sure I have the right one. Paul writes, as I've been listening, I thought it would be appropriate to bring something up again. Being efficient at using a computer, I was reminded of this when you all did the show on the dock. You talked about how to do some special things with the dock. For me, the dock is really just a way to see what is open. If I want to open an application, I use Spark, and he sent us a link, which is an awesome hotkey manager. I use it so much, I actually got rid of Mail and Safari from my dock, but of course they do appear once I've launched them. Spark is a great way to switch between apps without even going to the mouse. So definitely we'll put that in Cool Stuff Found, and we'll put a link out in the show notes for it. Second, I want to thank you for suggesting the SSD. After listening to show 209, I decided to purchase an SSD card or an SSD drive for my Express Card slot and use it as my boot drive. That way I can get great performance on apps and startup, as well as get a large hard drive for my files. I don't know if you had thought of it, but it really is a great way to get a boost in speed and not replace the internal hard drive. And he puts a link to a 48 gig Express Card drive that he found, and I think it was $175. I mean, it wasn't totally, you know, cost prohibitive, and gave him enough room to put his OS and his applications there. And then, of course, all of his documents, his songs, his pictures, everything else is being stored out there. And you know, you do get that huge performance boost from starting up from the drive. So that brings us into the SSD realm. And thank you. We've got links for all that stuff, and we'll put it out there in the show notes. So thanks, Paul. That's a good idea. Once I read this today, when I was going through the show, I started thinking, oh, wait a minute, this might be the right move, because you've got some play here. You've got the big drive still, you know, if I move 30 gigs of my OS off to a drive. Well, that, you know, now my 250 in the machine is, mm-hmm. you know, plenty huge. So interesting concept. Thank you, Paul, for that. So this moves us into the SSD realm. We Again. Have, yeah, yeah. For, you know, I was going to say for the last time, but I don't think so. This, no. just in the last week, I've heard from two companies off the record that SSD drives are coming out, and another company on the record, Crucial, announced, the big memory manufacturer, announced that they've got SSD drives that they're going to ship on July 20th, which is a week from today.
Not just 64, not just 128, but I think 256.
They've got a 256.
Gigs.
Yeah.
MLC, which right? that took me by surprise.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it, you know, this is happening. It's happening fast. A year from now, I think prices, you know, prices right now are, they're high, but you have to, you can't think of it as just a hard drive replacement. You have to think of it as a speed and in some ways reliability upgrade, especially for a laptop, because you don't have that moving part. So if the machine drops while you're traveling, much less chance of losing data mm-hmm. because you've damaged the drive or what have you. So yeah, very interesting. But of course, you know, we did have that that little tiff last week, the on air tiff.
Well, when
I had to smack you down, but
well, you attempted to do so,
but it forced some good research. And you discovered something called write amplification. And I'm not even sure how to translate this from
geek
to human.
Well, I'm
going to
try to translate it.
Okay, go ahead.
So here was your challenge. So when we were talking about the performance degradation of SSD drives when they get full, you challenged me when I said that writing the amount of data equal to the amount of the drive was sufficient to do that. You challenged me on that, and I don't blame you.
Sure, it sounded
is
reasonable.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, based on some of the cursory research I did, because I was digesting, I mean, you saw some of these articles. They were pretty big.
Yeah.
So the thing was, the algorithm, here's one problem. From what I understand, from what I read, the size of an erase block is larger than a write block on these drives. So that introduces complexity in and of itself.
Right.
If I can only write 4K, but I can only erase 16K, for example, which I think the you know, what we linked to, and if we didn't, we will, that introduces a little bit of complexity. When do I actually do an erase? Now, the reason I said that you may not achieve the full capacity of the drive when you're writing repeatedly. Now, one of the things that happens with these drives is the write amplification, and that the assumption is the amount of data they write out, taking into regard the characteristics of the drive with the write versus erase block size, is that you're going to be the assumption is the amplification will be greater than 1-to-1, in that if I have to rewrite 4K of data, the drive itself is actually going to be rewriting way more than that. Now, the review I read, the Intel, and I'm going to assume the Runcore and other drives have reduced this. My speculation was, if you have a smart OS and or controller, and here was the basis of why I was, you know, pushing back on this.
Sure.
Say I write a huge monstrous file with all the contents the same as another file I just recently wrote. My assumption would be not a lot has probably changed. In which case, could you get, and based on what I know about designing, you know, disk caches and firmware and stuff, drives are nowhere near this point to be this smart. But that was the spark that led me to push back to Dave.
Sure.
And that if you have a drive that is smart enough to say, you know, I got a megabyte file or a file and only a portion of it has changed, why am I telling a drive to write the whole darn thing over again? Now, again, I don't think any modern OS, unless modern mainstream OS, is smart enough to do this, nor do I think a modern mainstream drive is smart enough to do this, but I do know, and I cannot reveal more, that there are devices that do this. Well, that's all I can say.
That's an interesting point, right? Because right now it's entirely 100% up to the SSD drive manufacturers to solve this problem, right? I mean,
maybe the OS saying, you know, I don't need to write this. Well, I'm not going to tell you to do this because it's.
But that's what I'm saying. The OS hasn't been built to do this yet.
Correct.
Right? But yes. So currently the only solution rests on the shoulders of the drive manufacturers entirely. And
the cache, perhaps, I think the cache.
Yeah.
And cache is a whole other weird, wild, wacky world of hardware engineering and some software engineering where, you know, do you write it? Do you?
Right. But this stuff could get better. Right. Because let's think about this for a second. And I know we're getting long in the tooth with this show, but it's okay. We're not going to be here next week because I'm on vacation. So we'll ramble a little bit here.
Go.
Yeah. So defragmenting, right? That's about the worst thing that you could do to an SSD drive, right? Because if we know that reading from SSD, no problem. You can read all day long. Great. You know, it'll beat a hard drive any day of the week, even with the worst controller on the SSD. Right. I mean, in general. And I know that's an oversimplification. Yeah. But
they're not. But
let me get here because this is important. So a defrag, what you're doing is you're taking chunks of data and just moving them around on a SSD drive for no apparent gain, right? Or very little apparent gain, if any. You're just moving data around and writing and rewriting and rewriting constantly just for the sake of rewriting. And that's very bad and will cause some problems here in addition to wearing out the drive, right? Because you have a limited number of write cycles before an SSD drive starts to go bad, or before at least each cell starts to go bad. Now, OS X has hot file management, which is its own sort of defragmenting of smaller, regularly used files. But it is doing this in the background. Now, wouldn't it be great? You know, the first step to me is that OS X now should be aware that, you know, it's using an SSD drive and just disable hot file management, right? I mean, that would be the first step. But even better than that would be to optimize the driver architecture for SSD and say, okay, if I'm using a hard drive, I want to do things this way. If I'm using SSD, well, I want to do it a little bit differently here because it's a completely different medium. Treating them the same is not beneficial to either side, right? If you treat a hard drive like SSD, you're not going to get full performance. And if you treat SSD like a hard drive, you're not. So
the problem is, I think a hard drive, your assumption is sequential data is good, and optimization to achieve that goal is good, is putting all the blocks in order for a physical hard drive with today's technology is a great thing.
Right.
And for a SSD is a terrible
thing. It's terrible. Right. It just couldn't get
worse.
You're
doing all this work that is not necessary.
Right. And detrimental, certainly in the long term and perhaps even in the short term. That's right. So this is going to get interesting. And I think we're going to see, changes in the next year because I think in the next 6 weeks, we're going to see changes. It's happening really fast. We're having a lot of conversations with people who are coming out with these and want to advertise them and all that stuff. There's so much heat, and especially because we're in an upgrade market, right? In this economy, people aren't buying new computers as easily as they were before, but so instead of spending, between $1,000 and let's say, $3,000 on a new computer, if you can spend between, $1 and $500 on an upgrade for your existing machine that's actually going to make a difference, people, much more willing to do that. So that means RAM upgrades and that sort of thing are, very easy. And these SSD drives, especially when you take into account like Paul's idea of doing the dual drive system and put an SSD in that express card slot and then move on with, your data on the hard drive. That's a nice little, for less than $200 now, you've got most of the speed benefits of an SSD. So this is happening very, very quickly. And I think we will see operating systems probably Apple before anyone else, A, because that seems to be how they do things, and B, they are selling machines with SSD drives in them. So, you know, they've got some stake in this game. But, very interesting.
You know, they're first, and I've read this from people that were willing to pay the steep premium to have the single cell drives. I think they were Samsung drives in the first Air machines.
Right.
If you wanted to pay $1,000, you were going to get a good experience, but
it
cost you $1,000.
So. It cost you $1,000. Exactly. Right. Right. Yeah. No, this is interesting. So
I'm tempted because to me, 256 is a tipping point because the drive I have in my portable now is, I think, a 300 gig.
That's expensive, so, man. You're going to pay for a 256 SSD. I think the price to performance gain isn't there. You know, you're going to pay $800-$900 for a 256.
Okay, then I won't.
right, exactly.
But in a year?
In a year, exactly. It'll be half that.
I'll pay or less.
Yeah. I think that's probably right.
I'm thinking economies of scale because the reliability, the speed.
Big drive manufacturers, as you've seen, at the Pepcom shows, everybody is beating down this path.
They're all thinking or doing.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's still room. I mean, the race isn't over yet. There's still room for people to come out, you know, established brands and people that know what they're doing to come out with the right technology. These companies know they don't need to race, but they need to focus. And it's going to be interesting. So we won't talk about this every show, but I think this is in many ways a game changer. And we're just at that tipping point here where it's going to start. Going to start moving. So, and it's fun. You know, it's exciting.
You know, I've just been thinking, Dave.
Yeah.
I really want to get in touch with me.
You too?
Or you.
You could call your own phone.
Or the show. if you want to get in touch with the Mac Geek Gab, you know what I do, Dave?
What would you do?
I would first pick up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first, actually, I got a tip of the hat to our leading edge users. They are sending in comments using the wonderful new iPhone iPod Touch 3.0 hardware software, which includes a voice memo app. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. And we had
quality.
Chris's comment tonight was recorded that way, and we've gotten some others. It's so easy because what you do is you go into voice memos, you record your memo. It's not being compressed for the phone lines or anything. It nice high quality. And then right from there, you can email it to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Dave, did you say feedback@macgeekgab.com?
I did. feedback@macgeekgab.com. If you don't have the ability to do that, or you simply don't want to mess with the voice memo app, you certainly can call us. It's 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is...
I think that's 4335.
That's right. You can check out the show notes at MacGeekGab.com, which is also part of MacObserver.com. And you can Skype us your comments to MacGeekGab. But that, I will tell you, is going to give us the worst quality. And the reason is Skype's link. This is important, actually, to talk about. We've been doing those live shows, and people on the live show through TalkShoe say our quality's terrible. Well, I did some testing. Skype's outbound call quality, so the call quality that you hear when you use Skype out through the phone lines, whatever bridge they're using to link Skype to the plain old telephone network, is horrible. It's worse than any other VoIP I've tested anywhere. Yeah, so we're going to find a way. I've concocted a way of doing this with Gizmo so that we'll get a really high quality stream to TalkShoe, and we can start doing that on a more regular basis. So, but Skype, because you're calling in and it's then routing it to our 206-666-GEEK voicemail, it is the worst quality. So if you have the ability to record your own audio, and as John said, with the Voice Memos app, that's very easy right now. That's the way to do it. iTunes comments, we love. Blog World Expo is October 15th through 17th, and you can get 20% off a ticket and using this special code. You're very important to us. You're very important to them. We are Mac Observer, and the code is ObserverVIP, and that'll get you 20% off. iPhone Alley is Michael Johnston's home. when he is not converting this show to AAC for your pleasure. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Pathfinder 5 from Cocotec, which we will tell you more about in the next show, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And my throat, after talking all night on Saturday at the reunion, is shot, and I think I've got about maybe three more words left in me, John.
You were talking? Were you singing?
No. No, 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 no.
Did not grab a mic.
No, no singing. That was not necessary.
No. The only thing I have to assume, since you made it back from your reunion and all the shenanigans, Dave, is that you didn't get caught.
I did not.
May not.